From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to this year-end edition of Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will look back at some of our most interesting topics of 2017. Some people worry about American trade deficits, but during a visit to Raleigh this year, economist Donald Boudreau explained why those worries are unfounded. At least one professor at the UNC School of Government believes North Carolina should completely rewrite its criminal code. You'll learn why. Thanks to a popular Broadway play, we know more about Alexander Hamilton than many other American founders, but a Duke professor tells us that many people get Hamilton's politics wrong. And we'll hear an expert economist's concerns about a study that suggests the North Carolina economy gets better when people get sick. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
When CEOs choose to publicly engage in political debates, can their shareholders take them to court if that CEO's action hurt the value of the stock? Well, that is a key question addressed in a Wall Street Journal piece co-authored by the John Locke Foundation's Senior Vice President, John Pritchett. John joins us now to talk about this interesting subject. John, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
First of all, congratulations. You co-authored this with Ed Teriakin, who is a Duke University economics professor. Quite an honor to be published in the Wall Street Journal, first of
you
all.
You can check it off my bucket list. I've been reading it for 33 years.
Nice to see your own name there, too.
Yeah.
Why in the world did you decide to start writing about this issue of politics and shareholder value?
Well, I like to look at liberty and freedom and free markets through the lens of my experience, like anyone else. And a lot of my experience has been in business, and I'm also an investor. And so shareholder value is an important part of business. And at the same time, I'm also very interested in sort of the culture warfare that's going on. And so Ed and I have been talking about this subject. In our view, it's sort of akin to some of the other things that we've talked about and written about, like, for example, how the left is trying to use sports as a weapon and sort of a CEO social activism is along the same lines. So it just so happens that we've been working on this story for a little while. And then last week when we had all the resignations from the White House Council on Manufacturing, we said, you know what, that's a pretty good time for us to tighten up the story and submit it to the journal. And they agreed.
In your piece, you make an interesting point about one of the CEOs in particular who resigned from that business council. Those councils, by the way, President Trump has shut down. But this CEO had an opportunity to be face-to-face with the President of the United States, and one would think that that would be something valuable for that organization, even if that CEO disagreed completely with the President, either what he said or didn't say about Charlottesville or any other policy. One would think a CEO would want to keep that seat?
Yeah, so that's particularly agitating for me. You know, if you think about The Godfather, it's not personal, it's business. When you're the CEO of a publicly traded company, and to be clear and make the distinction, difference between a CEO of a private company and the CEO of a publicly traded company, there is a fiduciary responsibility. There's something called shareholder primacy, where your job as the CEO, and you're paid well for it, is to take care of long-term shareholder value, is to increase market share, is to create profits. That is your job. And by the way, that's a really good, big job and an important job because when we think about it, that's how the market works. And so, you know, that should be enough, sort of full stop, right, period. You have the opportunity to create opportunity for employment and jobs and wealth creation, and then people can decide what they want to do with that wealth creation. When all of a sudden it becomes a personal issue, and you see people resign from, in this case, you're talking about Ken Frazier at Merck, who is the head of one of the largest companies in the pharma industry. He is sitting amongst the leaders of the government who regulate an industry. An industry, by the way, which has been, in my view, overly regulated and is in need of some sort of serious regulatory reform, which could be helpful to the business, which can be helpful to the economy, which can be helpful to all of us. And to resign from that opportunity to be setting the agenda, to be with policymakers and with the door closed, having these sorts of conversations that we all know and many times is how you are able to get your ideas across to those who regulate industry. It seems to me if you had a personal problem with that, either one, put on your big boy pants and get over that issue because you're doing something greater than representing yourself. You're representing your company, therefore your shareholders. And to make it personal, you know, perhaps it's a personal conviction, and the CEO in this case, maybe Ken Frazier, felt so it was so important for him that he could not be in these meetings, then my suggestion would be, okay, have your CFO go, have your COO go, have your general counsel go. You want the company, Pfizer, in the middle of this regulatory debate. He took the company out of it. And in my view, that's such an overreaction to this media hysteria. And so, again, back to the Godfather, right? It's business. It's not personal.
What is a shareholder to do if they take a look at their investment and say, hey, wait a second, this activist CEO made this public decision, and it appears that the stock price is falling because of that? Do you have recourse?
So Ed Tiriakin and I looked at this issue, and we said, what does history say about recourse for shareholders? And there's a lot of legal history. One of the landmark cases we referenced in the article, 1919 case, which was Dodge v. Ford. Henry Ford had created a very valuable company and was generating lots of money and decided at a certain point that rather than dividends to his shareholders, he was going to give money away for good causes. As you might imagine, some of the shareholders had a different idea about that.
Admirable.
As it might be.
But they're shareholders.
They were saying basically let us decide if we want to give away the money as shareholders, right? That shouldn't be your personal decision. And the courts upheld that. Now, what a lot of legal scholars will say, and they're correct, is that there is a business judgment rule. There is latitude. And even in that case, there was latitude given to a chief executive about the rationale of making decisions. But that is not to say it's without limits. You still have this primacy of shareholder. You still have this process that you go through when you get information, you deliberate, is this in the best long-term interest of the company and the shareholders? And that's where we suggest when shareholders, when boards won't hold CEOs accountable for this sort of CEO social activism, then there is the ability to go to court. And it's not as difficult as one might think. Particularly if you're a small shareholder. Lots of people will say, well, all of these companies have institutional shareholders, and those are big companies. But they're made up of small retiree teachers and other folks who have pension and retirement programs where they may own several shares of that stock, and therefore they have standing to sue. And in our view, when we can't get an answer to something through the governance, a corporate governance, and we have to turn to the courts.
Some of those people you mentioned may not even realize all the different stocks that they own through mutual funds and things like that. Just average folks who are invested a little bit in the market for retirement, and this could be happening and they wouldn't know. In our final minutes with you, John, I'd like to talk to you briefly about the situation with Target, which you reference in the Wall Street Journal piece. We know in North Carolina we went through the situation with House Bill 2. Target CEO strongly opposed House Bill 2, which has since been repealed, but he came out with what he termed an inclusive bathroom policy. Tell us what happened after that.
Yeah, so in our view, again, this is a social activism piece that from a shareholder standpoint you get upset about because you realize that, and you're talking about Brian Cornell, when he made the decision to issue this this program, he really obviously didn't consider this is the business rationale process that we were talking about. I didn't really consider the implications of customers, for example. and made the decision because he felt, for whatever reason, that this was something he was interested in. My view is he'd be better off doing that with his own personal money if that's what his interest is, and not necessarily Target, because, as you know, a lot of the customers of Target decided to boycott, and as a result, we saw a $20 billion drop in market cap.
John Pritchett, who is Senior Vice President with the John Locke Foundation, he co-wrote this with Ed Teriakin, who is at Duke University. And you can read this piece at johnlocke.org and also, of course, at the Wall Street Journal's website. John Pritchett, thank you very much.
Thanks, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The United States has a trade deficit. Is that bad? Does it matter much at all? Well, joining us to help answer that question is one of the most astute observers of the public policy arena and economics issues, Professor Donald Boudreau of George Mason University. Thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be back.
So we do have this trade deficit, and a lot of people say, this is terrible. We need to do something about it. Do we need to do anything about the trade deficit?
No. No, we've had a trade deficit for straight now going on almost 40 years. If you look at most of U.S. history going back to 1607 when the English settled Jamestown, the vast majority of those years has been trade deficits. A trade deficit is just a fancy name for foreigners investing a lot in your country. And that's not bad. That's good because more capital comes into America. That creates jobs, that expands businesses, that creates new products, that raises wages, that increases the capital value of people's homes and assets. You can tell a story in which trade deficits are a symptom of something bad, but it's kind of a strained story. But in the case of the United States, we run a trade deficit because compared to other countries, we remain an attractive investment destination. Property rights are still reasonably secure. There's still a rule of law. We still largely have a market-oriented economy with a lot of dynamism. We have a large market. All of those factors attract capital here. People want to invest their money here. And so when they sell us things, when foreigners sell us things, rather than cash out all of their dollars immediately buying American exports, they take some of those dollars and they invest them in the United States. The dollars come back to the U.S. They just come back differently than they would come back if they were all for exports. And it's the difference in how they come back that leads to this artifact, this accounting artifact called the trade deficit. But it sounds bad. And Mitch, I've talked about this issue now for 20 years pretty solidly, and I follow it very closely. And I guarantee this is not an exaggeration. I would say that 90% of the news reporters, the editorial writers, the news media, even in some of the better business journals like the Wall Street Journal, 90% don't know what the trade deficit is. They just hear trade deficit. Deficit sounds bad. Therefore, the trade deficit must be bad. They equate it with increasing debt. Sounds like the government budget deficit. It has nothing. It's not the same thing at all. And so because it has a bad sounding name, and people keep repeating over and over again that it spells our doom or it's a symptom of our bad practices, that it must be bad. It's not bad. By and large, I think it's a good, healthy sign, and it also promotes economic health better than health would be in the absence of the trade deficit.
That is the voice of Donald Boudreau, professor of economics at George Mason University. You mentioned that trade deficit, just the term, sounds bad.
Deficit sounds bad.
Yeah. But aren't there other factors also contributing to why so many people think it actually is bad, sort of the old mercantilist view of the economy?
Yes, it's a mercantilist concept. It dates back to centuries, long before the Industrial Revolution. I like what Adam Smith said about the whole balance of trade doctrine. The trade deficit is part of this whole balance of trade issue. And I quote Adam Smith, quote, "Nothing, however, can be as absurd as this whole doctrine of the balance of trade," end quote. It's a completely absurd doctrine. It's premised on the notion, which is the mercantilist notion, that countries are like businesses. They're just like big businesses. And a country succeeds in trade, the more it exports and the less it imports. With the difference being made up by a receipt of money. As Adam Smith pointed out, people can't eat money. People can't house themselves in money. Money is a medium of exchange. Money is valuable only insofar as ordinary men and women can use that money to buy the goods and services that make their lives better off, that raise their standards of living. And so it's not contrary to the mercantilist notion, contrary to the trade deficit fear. It's not a bad thing when Americans import. It's a good thing. Imports are the benefit we get from trading. Unfortunately, we have to pay for those imports, and exports are the price we pay. This is the complete opposite of the mercantilist myth that sees exports as a benefit. Wow, we're giving stuff away to foreigners. And imports as a cost we have to pay. Wow, and in exchange, we're getting all these consumer electronics and cars and petroleum and clothing. How terrible. We got to minimize that. But you know, this is the notion that the Trump people have, and in it's completely wrong. But in fairness to the Trump people, they are just more open and consistent in their mercantilism, more blatant about their embrace of this myth than most other politicians. There are exceptions, but you show me a politician, I'll scratch that politician and I will find a mercantilist not too far beneath the surface.
Not to get overly wonkish, but some people look at a particular statistic called gross domestic product as one of the greatest things that you should be focusing on in terms of the economy. And if you do focus on GDP, one of its components is exports over imports. So you would think we need to have more exports than imports. Why is that wrong?
Well, it's wrong for a couple of different reasons. And it's hard not to get too terribly wonk. I'll try to do it. I don't know if I'll succeed. When fashioned in its national income form, income equals consumption plus investment plus government spending minus exports minus imports, the consumption spending is already – the dollars in consumption are already counted in C and I to the extent that investors spend. And so just to make the accounting work, just honestly, we have to – the international accounts have to subtract those expenditures that are made on imports. If we didn't, we'd count twice. Right? So if I buy, I can leave a good example now without getting too wonkish. So at one level, it's just an accounting measure that's necessary to avoid double counting. A somewhat different reason that's complementary to that is when foreigners. As I said, when we run a trade deficit, what that means is foreigners are investing in America. And then when foreigners invest in America, that increases the size of our capital stock. We have more factories. We have improved factories. We have more worker R&D. Over time, that increases the productivity of the economy, which raises, if it's measured properly, GDP. There are lots of problems with using GDP as a measure of economic welfare. Putting those – I think it's okay. Putting those aside, over time, the trade deficit should result in higher GDP because it increases the productivity of the economy.
In general, has it been true that when our economy is operating well, operating as well as it can – we're operating with trade deficits and even larger trade deficits as things get better?
Oh, absolutely. All a trade deficit means is that foreigners are especially eager to invest in America. There's nothing wrong with that. Just nothing at all. But to invest in America, foreigners need dollars, and they get dollars by selling us stuff. So we gain. We Each American voluntarily chooses or not to buy something from a foreigner. The foreigner voluntarily chooses or not how then to spend or to invest those monies. If all along the way each party gains from these many series of individual bilateral voluntary trades, how can it be that the overall result is negative?
Well, if you have the wrong idea about trade deficits, don't blame Donald Boudreau, professor of economics at George Mason University. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some North Carolina legal reformers are focusing on a concept called mens rea, meaning that people need to have a guilty mind to be convicted of a crime. But during a recent forum on the topic, UNC professor Jessica Smith raised a larger issue.
The bigger problem is that in North Carolina, we lack a streamlined, comprehensive, orderly, and principled criminal code. And that causes a number of problems. One is it causes tremendous inefficiency in the system, which drives up costs for everybody in the system. It also leads for opportunities for unfairness. And in the end, I think it actually undermines the criminal law. So what do I mean when I say we lack a streamlined, comprehensive, orderly, and principled code? Well, we have Chapter 14 in the North Carolina General Statutes that is entitled our criminal code. It's criminal law. It has most of the codified offenses in North Carolina, but felony offenses can be found in 53 separate chapters of the General Statutes. Misdemeanors can be found in 143 separate chapters of the general statutes. And that's not all. Under North Carolina law, we delegate the authority to create criminal law to administrative boards and bodies. So, for example, the Board of Dental Examiners is allowed to create crimes by regulation. And a dentist who advertises services without specifying whether he is a generalist or a specialist dentist is a criminal in North Carolina. In addition to delegating to administrative boards and bodies, North Carolina law also delegates authority to cities, counties, towns, and metropolitan sewerage districts, the authority to create crimes by ordinance. So one tiny town in North Carolina, population just over 5,000, has a local ordinance that says it is unlawful to allow chickens to be at large in the town. A person who allows chickens to be at large in that town has committed a Class 3 misdemeanor under North Carolina law. In addition to this, our code, the part that is codified, is incomplete. We haven't dealt with a host of principles and concepts that are central to criminal law.
That's UNC professor Jessica Smith. She's making the case for reform of North Carolina's overly complicated criminal code. Reform would require action from the General Assembly. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation, we're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Mention the name Alexander Hamilton today, and you're likely to encounter at least some measure of recognition. We see his face on the $10 bill, and many people have heard of a Broadway musical devoted to this American founder. But what do people know about Hamilton's actual record or his approach to public policy? Our next guest says many people on both the political left and right get Hamilton wrong. Richard Zalzman is assistant professor of political economy at Duke University. He recently addressed the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society on the topic Hamilton's Liberalism, Facts and Myths. Thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here. Thank you, Mitch.
So before we get into what Alexander Hamilton really believed, how do people on both the left and right get him wrong?
On the left, to which today are called liberals, they're actually advocates of heavy government intervention in the economy. And they interpret Hamilton as their supporter. On the right, if you want to go far to the right, say the libertarians, who some of them lean more anarchist, also think he's a statist, also think that Hamilton's a statist and tend to endorse Jeffersonian principles. I use liberal in the classical sense, in the Lockean, Montesquieuian sense, that liberal meaning pro-liberty. And in classical liberalism, the term itself was required to distinguish from modern liberalism. We had to go back and say, well, no, they were classical liberals. They actually wanted constitutionally limited government. They actually wanted a free economy. That's Hamilton. That's in – my theme has been that is Hamilton through and through. He is not a statist. So he can't be criticized by the right for that, nor claimed by the left for that. He occupies this position of being a true classical liberal. He believed in equal rights for all. He was against racism and slavery. Possibly the most important beyond that, the constitutional limitations on government. The anti-federalists, who are largely Jeffersonian, initially opposed the forming of a constitution. They wanted the 13 states to remain separate. Hamilton effectively put the U in the USA. So he's a constitutionally he's for constitutionally limited government as well. And lastly, I also talk about political economy and foreign policy. In political economy, he's pro-capitalist in the following sense. He believes all sectors of the economy are productive, not just agriculture, you know, but also manufacturing and finance and trade, whereas the Jeffersonians, literally adopting what was amounted to physiocracy from France, believed only agriculture was productive. They said even that only virtuous, which by implication meant all the other sectors were in some ways parasitical. So the whole class warfare that we see today between Main Street and Wall Street and, you know, real workers versus these paper shufflers is totally a Jeffersonian type distinction. And lastly, we can talk about it, but foreign policy, he's a realist. He puts national interests first. He doesn't think we should make the world safe for democracy because ultimately he doesn't trust democracy. He doesn't trust unlimited majority rule. He thinks it can become tyranny, whereas the Jeffersonians are largely for unlimited majority rule.
We're speaking with Richard Salzman, assistant professor of political economy at Duke University, and we're talking, of course, about Alexander Hamilton, who many of you have heard of at least as the subject of a Broadway musical and perhaps as the person whose face is on the $10 bill. There was some discussion about taking Hamilton –
plus the duel. Plus
the duel with Aaron Burr.
The vice president killed him. Yes,
that's right. That's right. There was some discussion about taking Hamilton's face off the $10 bill.
Yes.
He was rescued, and I suspect – as someone who's talking about him as the consummate classical liberal, you're glad he's going to stay on that bill.
I am glad, and I wrote at the time that he should remain on the bill. But they wanted a more democratic choice, and so it couldn't have been more curious, because here was Hamilton basically saying a democracy can be very dangerous. It can actually lead to fiscal profligacy and bankruptcy of the state. So here he is because of unlimited majority desire for spending without taxing. You know, there's like a built-in bias toward deficit spending. That's another myth about Hamilton. He's seen sometimes as, well, since he wanted to pay the national debt, he must have been one of these proto-Keynesians who wanted national debt or thought government debt was somehow stimulative. None of that's true either. So, yes, I wanted him to stay on the 10. That doesn't necessarily mean people know more about Hamilton, but to get him off the currency to me seemed unjust and improper.
Why do people have the wrong idea about Alexander Hamilton?
I think some of it is Jefferson and the Jeffersonians tend to be more lyrical, poetic, and flowery in their writings and speeches. Hamilton is more lawyerly, more dry, more logical, more prolix, actually, which is another word for using too many words. And so that's part of it. But I think part of it also is the when people look back to the founders, they want to see them as condoning or supporting their current position, you know. So it's like almost like an appeal to authority. And since Jefferson and Hamilton disagreed on so much, and I'm saying legitimately disagreed, I mean, there were big differences between there of the kind I've just mentioned. If you're at all a Jeffersonian, you think Hamilton's the devil, because Jefferson did. And Jeffersonian biographers and scholars think Hamilton's the devil. So we have this kind of, you know, Jefferson as Dudley Do-Right and, you know, Hamilton as Snidely Whiplash, you know, if you know the old cartoons. And so some of it is just sheer caricature, which is not the same thing as historical accuracy.
I get the sense also that if you look back at these debates between Jefferson and Hamilton, Jefferson obviously wrote great things, had great ideas. Hamilton sometimes seems to come across as the person who had a better grip on how the world actually works. Would you agree with that?
Well, when you say actually works, that gets back to my point about realism. Yes, Hamilton's basic view was, let's take humanity as it is, the good and the bad of it. People have free will. They could choose to do good or ill. Let's not become idealistic or idyllic about what's possible. Specifically, he said, let's not become that way about the populace in general. Jefferson and the Jeffersonians generally thought, in a Rousseau-type way, that the more you could capture what was called the general will or majority opinion, they literally thought that was more accurate They had, and so the distrust for elites, the distrust for expert opinion. We see this even today. The distrust of establishment. These are debates we have even today, right? The suspicion is the elites and the establishment have only their own self-aggrandizement at heart. The Jeffersonians think that's always checked by the popular will. Hamilton and the Federalists thought, you know, the popular will is easily demagogued, easily exploited by those who take advantage of people's prejudices, ignorance. And so he was much more suspicious of politicians like Jefferson, frankly, who would use flowery language and appeal to the people as a kind of flattering of the people.
So in the remaining time that we have, if people want to learn more about Hamilton, what he actually stood for, why he is an important founder, why he should stay on the $10 bill, what's the best thing for them to do?
Well, a couple of pieces by me, if you just Google Salzman defense of Hamilton, you'll get one or two pieces specifically on him on the bill a couple of years ago. But I would name a couple of books. One, Ron Chernow's biography of Hamilton in 2004 is very good and was actually the basis for the musical. So for those of you who are interested in the musical and its origins, it basically comes from Chernow's wonderful biography. More philosophically, there's a book by Michael Federici, called The Political Philosophy of Alexander Hamilton. That's a little more scholarly, a little more in-depth as to his actual views. That's a very good book as well.
Well, Alexander Hamilton, more than just the face on the $10 bill and more than just the subject of a musical and a person who says that we should recognize him as the consummate classical liberal, is Richard Salzman, assistant professor of political economy at Duke University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Full color throughout every issue, more visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read, a new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. No, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal, we hold government accountable to you. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Flawed economics, that is the conclusion of the John Locke Foundation's senior economist, Dr. Roy Cordato, after he analyzed a report that concludes North Carolina's hospitals and healthcare systems boost the state's economy. Dr. Cordato joins us now to explain why getting sick really isn't that big boost that some people say it is. Roy, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be back, Donna.
Tell us why you decided to write about this issue, healthcare economics, essentially.
Well, when you look at this study, I was glancing at it and I realized, well, what they were telling us beyond initially what they're saying, which is, well, you know, hospitals spend this money and invest in equipment and doctors and nurses and so on. And therefore, that money ripples through the economy, increases GDP. What is unstated is what initially generates that spending is people getting sick.
Which right? We usually don't want to happen to people.
That's right. The idea, if you think about their study carefully, they say this spending on the part of hospitals boosts the economy. But what boosts that spending on the part of the economy? Well, people getting sick and needing medical treatment. And the implication of the study is the more people are sick, the more costs there are associated with them, hospital costs in particular, and therefore the better it is for the economy. And that's crazy. And the problem is that they don't consider the fact that people would be spending this money otherwise if they weren't getting sick. And the real benefit of this government spending, or I'm sorry, of this hospital spending, isn't that they're hiring more doctors and nurses. That's a cost. The benefit is, and they'll talk about this at all, is, okay, well, there are benefits, lives saved, medical conditions avoided and so on, but they don't even discuss any of those, which are the true benefits of that spending.
Roy, how would an industry come up with a conclusion like this? So you really got deep into the analysis of how they went about determining what is a cost and what is a benefit.
Yes.
Talk to us about that.
Well, it's very slippery. This study is very slippery because they start out by saying, well, we're going to look at all these hospital expenditures on capital equipment, on doctors, nurses, and so on. And they never identify them as costs. But the fact is that all these things are healthcare costs. And if you look in the literature, no one views increased healthcare costs as a good thing. They all see it as a burden on economic growth, and it's a thing to be minimized. And it's something that we've devoted a lot of policy, both state and federal, to try to minimize those costs, right? But they never call them costs. First, they call them expenditures. And then in the study, they say, this is actually a benefits analysis. So they suddenly start calling them benefits. Avoiding the whole notion that really what they're talking about is added healthcare costs essentially being good for the economy, which flies in the face of all economic analysis of healthcare costs.
Why would someone produce a report like this?
Well, it's special interest. I mean, this was put out by the North Carolina Hospital Association. They are a trade association that wants everyone to think that you know what they do has this great benefit for the economy, and it's the study is done by a Research Triangle Institute, which is paid for by North Carolina Hospital Association. So they're basically being paid to give a result that the Hospital Association wants to see, and they use an economic impact model called IMPLAN, which is really designed to show how great an impact a particular industry is having. There's no such thing within the context of that model of actually any industry having a negative impact. And I've written about that elsewhere.
And interesting that you point out economics aside, I don't think there's anyone listening to our voices that would disagree that the positive impact of hospitals and doctors and nurses and radiologists and cancer specialists is that they're saving lives.
They're saving lives. And of course, there are benefits. But the fact is that everything they identify is the cost of generating that benefits. They are not the benefits. Really, these healthcare costs are not adding to GDP. They're absorbing GDP. They're not adding to jobs. They are actually absorbing part of the labor force to do these things. If that part of the GDP was liberated to do other things by either reducing healthcare costs, making it more efficient, or having, you know, fewer sick people, we'd all be better off. But I mean, there are crazy, if you think about the implications of this, it's really crazy. You know, if smoking causes more cancer, that means more people will go into hospitals. Hospitals will spend more, and that's going to increase GDP. I mean, that's actually if you think about the absurdity of this study, that's where it takes you.
Now, I have known you for a number of years, and I know that this happens to be what I would call one of your pet peeves.
No, absolutely.
Economic impact studies. So this is not the first time that you've taken a look at a study like this. And often, Roy, we see this sometimes at the local government level,
right,
where you will have a proposal on the table to say a county commissioners group that they want to use taxpayer money to build a hotel.
Yeah, hotel,
convention center,
stadium. And you get the same kind of thing, right? They act like there's no cost. That what these things do are examine expenditures, and always assuming that if that money didn't go to whatever it is, the stadium or the convention center, it wasn't going to go in somewhere else. So they don't take into consideration the possibility that any of that money or the jobs or whatever would go elsewhere if it wasn't being channeled by the government expenditure into building whatever it is the project is.
Roy, some of this that you're describing is pretty fundamental economics.
Basic.
Why then is it that these types of economic impact studies, not just in North Carolina,
mm-hmm,
but
everywhere,
they exist everywhere,
right,
when you hear a proposal to build something or do something? What is it that folks like you can be doing? Is it just talking more about this to try to get people to understand what's happening?
Yeah, I think we do. We have to get legislators to understand, to look at these things very critically. Because look, the real reason these things, a trade association or something puts a lot of money into these things is because they expect to affect legislation one way or another. And, you know, right now, for example, there's a certificate of need laws. Well, hospital association, that's, are very much against those. And they want to say, look, we are doing all these great things. You shouldn't do anything that hurts hospitals. Look how good this is for your economy. So what we want to do is try to make legislators especially understand that they need to look at these studies with a very, very critical eye and understand what they are saying and what they are not saying.
What about for those of us who are taxpayers? If you're living in a city or a county and you hear that there's a proposal to spend more tax dollars on building something, what could just an average taxpayer do? What should they know in order to perhaps go to that city council meeting and start asking questions?
Well, absolutely. I think what they should do is go to a city council meeting armed with our research.
at
johnlock.org. Seriously, I mean, we've done a lot on this. In the last few months, I've written several papers on this issue and say, hey, look, this was done and here are the problems. Because, look, they all have the same problems. Kind of no matter what the source, what the issue is, the models that they use have all the same problems. They're commercial models. They're meant to generate big numbers.
And the key is to make sure that costs as well as benefits are identified.
That's right. And costs are almost never identified. In fact, what they do is that they may identify costs, but then they call them benefits.
Dr. Roy Cordato has been writing about this. And, of course, you can find his analysis of this particular economic impact study at johnlock.org, along with all of his other writing. Roy Cordato, thanks so much.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll come back again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlock.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlock.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.